Well, I don't know what the Russian plan is. Remember, I'm not an agent of the Russian government. So they haven't called me, and I'm not under orders to say anything to spread Russian disinformation or information or whatever. Look, I mean, we know that Russia has an interest in stability. Russia's interests are not destabilized. Russia's hosting the BRICS conference in October. This is a big deal. It's the middle of August. The last thing Russia needs is a broad Middle Eastern war that destabilizes not only the Middle East, but the world. That would have a devastating impact on the BRICS conference. Iran, you know, is a new member of BRICS, and you know, Iran is looking for a new relationship with the world defined by its relationship with BRICS. And you know, getting involved in a existential war against Israel is not in the national security interests of Iran, but Iran can't leave unanswered the assassination of the senior Hamas leader in Tehran by Israel. You know, I think Russia succeeded in buying time. One of the important things that Russia did was immediately fly in military equipment, primarily, I think, S-400 surface-to-air missiles, anti-ballistic missiles. They are now operational inside Iran. And this changes a lot from the Israeli perspective, because now Israel has to deal with a very advanced level of defense capacity that could be manned by Russia, could have connectivity with Russian satellites and things of that nature. So it changes a lot when it comes to, you know, any potential Israeli counterstrikes. And so what Russia is doing is compelling Israel to, you know, rethink its plan, because Iran will have to retaliate. There's no doubt about this. There will have to be an Iranian retaliation. And it's going to have to be more serious than the retaliation that took place in April. In April was a demonstration of capability, now, or of potential. And now I think whatever Iran does is going to have to demonstrate that that potential is reality, or else Iran loses any notion of deterrence, that Israel will have a green light to do anything it wants to do. So I think the Russians are talking about not just, you know, the Iranian retaliation, but then what happens next, because you can't say that you believe in bringing stability to the Middle East and all you do is limit Iranian retaliation, because after you limit that and the situation goes away, how do you resolve the underlying crisis that created this? It was a Hamas leader that was assassinated in Tehran. That Hamas leader was a lead negotiator for bringing an end to the conflict in Gaza. And it is the conflict in Gaza that has mobilized the axis of resistance led by Iran against Israel. And so by inviting Abbas in, I think, you know, people are like, oh, does that mean that Russia is abandoning Hamas? You know, because China just had this big conference where they brought 14 different Palestinian factions together into a singularity, including Hamas and Fatah. But Abbas is the president of the Palestinian Authority. And right now he continues to be the face of legitimacy of the Palestinian state, or what passes for a Palestinian state. He has no credibility amongst the Palestinian people, and pretty much zero credibility around the world. He's recognized as an old, feeble, corrupt person. So why is Putin meeting with him? I think, you know, this might be the equivalent of Nancy Pelosi's conversation with Joe Biden, which is, it's time for you to go. You need to step aside. You need to relinquish power. If you want to live here in Moscow, maybe we'll give you a nice dacha out there. But it's time for you to get out of the way. Your day is done. You are more of a problem than you are a solution. The Palestinian people view you as a shill for Israel, because you are a shill for Israel. I think that might be the conversation that's taking place in much more diplomatic terms by the Russians, who initiated, by the way. They're the ones, you know, the Chinese may have closed the deal, but it was the Russians who originally talked to Hamas and Fatah about coming together and creating this generic governmentation, a governmental representation for the Palestinian people. It's absolutely essential, because Israel says we will never deal with Hamas. So sort of taking the page out of the American book, you know, back when the YPG in Syria, the Kurdish independent group, it's really a front for the PKK, which is a Turkish Kurdish independence group that Turkey and much of the world says is a terrorist organization, including the United States. And yet we're dealing with the YPG, which is an adjunct to the PKK. And the United States is like, well, we can't deal with terrorists. How do we handle this? Why don't you guys just call yourself something different? We'll call you the Syrian Democratic Forces. Problem solved. You're still the same terroristic son of a bitch we were dealing with last week. We just changed your name. And, you know, that's sort of the approach Russia's taking, which is let's take Hamas, blend them up with Fatah, and we got something different that's not called Hamas. And now the Israelis will have to deal with this. That's the idea. But they can't as long as Israel keeps interfacing with Hamas. As long as Israel says this is the legitimate face of the Palestinian people. So I think Abbas is the problem. Abbas has to go and make way for this new thing that China and Russia have come up with. Let's back up just a second here. One, Israel made it clear that if Iran attacks precipitously in a manner that brings about Israeli civilian casualties, that Israel will have to respond, and they will respond by attacking Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Some of that nuclear infrastructure is buried underground, and the conventional bunker-busting bombs that the United States has provided to Israel can't penetrate it, which means that if Israel were to follow through with its threat to attack the nuclear infrastructure, and that threat was to have any meaning that you have to destroy that which you attack, Israel will have to use a nuclear bunker-busting weapon. That means that Israel would use nuclear weapons against Iran. And that's really an outcome nobody wants, because that just uncorks the nuclear genie and it will never be recorked until Israel itself is destroyed by nuclear weapons, one way or another. And so Russia basically said, okay, we have to do a couple things. We have to buy time. So the Russians bought time. They do that by providing capability. And the capability is designed to make Iran's nuclear infrastructure and other critical infrastructure a much more difficult target. Remember, hitting Iran is not going to be easy. Israel will have to, you know, fly long distances. They will have to refuel. And then they will have to penetrate layered air defense to get to the target they want to bomb and then get out of there. Israel had a certain attack profile already determined based upon Iran's existing air defense capabilities. And they had rehearsed that because this is something that just doesn't happen on the seat of the pants. It's a very carefully rehearsed strike package that Israel's run through the Negev desert, and they have all their plans in and they know how to do this. And Russia just made all the Israeli plans go away because now Israel has to deal with the S-400, which is a completely different ballgame. And Russia brought in other intelligence collecting capabilities, electronic warfare capabilities. Basically, they just made this problem of bombing Iran orders of magnitude more difficult. And so that's changed the Israeli response, which means now that Israel will have to increase its threshold of pain, because Israel isn't going to just go out there and blow things up if they can lose a whole bunch of pilots, a whole bunch of airplanes. They do risk management. And so by increasing the pain threshold, meaning that now Israel, in order to carry out that strike, they're going to have to lose a lot of equipment. That means that Israel now will be willing to absorb some pain as long as the pain delivered by Iran isn't as great. And so now Russia turns to the Iranians and says, if you need to attack, it needs to be a very focused attack on a very specific target. And no civilian casualties. And so Iran right now is revising its target planning, I believe. It has come up with a series of targets that it believes it can destroy, but it also believes that it won't result in civilian casualties. So the goal is to hit Israel and then absorb whatever Israel is willing to deliver, but it won't be strategic because of the Russian defenses, and then bring this thing to an end. Once again, to bring it an end. Nobody wants a wider war, and nobody wants a wider war more than Russia, because it will be devastating to the year of BRICS. This is the year of BRICS. BRICS is supposed to be the big thing. And right now, the Russian dream of BRICS dominance is being threatened by Ukrainian invasion in Kursk and this chance of a greater, wider, broader war in the Middle East between Iran and Israel. The United States has a history of back-channel diplomacy with Iran. We saw that with the Iran nuclear deal. The JCPOA began with a series of secret meetings between people, including Jake Sullivan, by the way. Jake Sullivan was one of the original secret meters, back-channelists, working with Iran. And, you know, this has been, I mean, go back all the way to Oliver North delivering a cake and a Bible, I guess, to the Iranian leadership, or Quran. I don't know what he delivered, but, you know, delivering stuff. We've been doing it for a while. And there's no doubt in my mind that we still have these back channels. I'm pretty sure that we talk with the Iranians to deconflict, to avoid allowing disagreements, sometimes even violent disagreements, from exploding into general war. It's in neither nation's interest. So there's no doubt in my mind that if such a back channel exists, it's being used today. And if it didn't exist, that the United States and Iran would be receptive to create it, because Iran doesn't need a war with Israel. But Iran's in an extraordinarily difficult position now because of what Israel did. And the United States recognizes that. The United States now is between a rock and a hard place, because they can't be seen as abandoning Israel. But on the other hand, they do not want to be part of a process of facilitating a broader conflict, which would, if it takes place, inevitably bring the United States, you know, into direct confrontation with Iran. So, yeah, in the interest of peace, I would hope that the United States is engaged in serious back-channel diplomacy with Israel to try and mitigate this crisis. I don't think the Biden administration, first of all, I don't think any back-channel discussion between Iran and the United States is seeking to bring about an end to the overall, that's just not going to happen. It's not feasible. The United States isn't capable of pulling that off. I think whatever back-channel discussions are taking place are designed to prevent a broader war. That's it. And then once that happens, then I think the United States is recognizing the importance of the role of Russia and China in this. The United States will use whatever leverage it can against Israel to try and bring the two points together. This is a problem that will not be solved by the United States and the United States alone. So the idea that the United States is carrying out some sort of magic peace formula behind the scenes with Russia, I think is not founded in reality. I think whatever conversations they're having are purely limited to how do we keep this war from spinning out of control? How do we convince the Iranians that while we will defend Israel and while we'll be seen posturing as being there for Israel, that, you know, we're not going to be part of any Israeli retaliation. And notice the United States hasn't screamed bloody murder about the deployment of Russian air defense systems into Iran. I mean, normally, you know, we're going to sanction everybody. Everybody's going to die of sanctions. Nothing. Why? Because the United States understands that that is actually bringing stability to the region, because Israel's out of control. Even the United States recognizes that Benjamin Netanyahu is totally out of control. The dual assassinations that took place in Beirut and Tehran, you know, were just a direct slap in the face of the United States, where the United States told them that we're not going to support a broader war with Iran or a broader war with Lebanon. So Netanyahu went back and said, kill senior people. Now what are you going to do about it? Because America, having wrapped Benjamin Netanyahu in the flag, is now trapped. Having anointed him to be the leader of Israel, they're now trapped because, yeah, he didn't invade. The Pentagon said, don't invade. All he did is assassinate a bad guy. And the Americans were, you know, our position is both those guys who were killed are bad guys. So how do we oppose it? Netanyahu is a smart guy, able to play the Americans like a finely tuned clock. But now he has to live with the consequences, and I think he's hopeful. I don't think Netanyahu wants a broader war either, because if there is a broader war, it's going to be devastating for Israel, extraordinarily. And Hezbollah sent a message the other night, firing dozens of rockets into an Israeli military facility in northern Israel, and the Iron Dome didn't respond. Why? Well, no one is talking. Did they hack it? probably. You know, but Hezbollah is saying, we can shut you down like that. And then the places you think are defended aren't. And if we can do it, so can Big Brother, because it was probably Big Brother that did it. If you don't think there's Iranian electronic warfare specialists embedded with Hezbollah, then you don't have any understanding about the Hezbollah-Iranian relationship. We're limited politically, domestically, politically. We're incapable of putting forward meaningful policy that can pressure Israel because of the extent of Israeli control over the American Congress, of the American presidency, of the American establishment. Pro-Israeli, resources are embedded everywhere. They're embedded at CNN, they're embedded at ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, Fox. It's all pro-Israeli. New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, all pro-Israeli. The President of the United States, owned by AIPAC. The Vice President of the United States, owned by AIPAC. The Secretary of Defense, owned by AIPAC and the defense industry. Speaker of the House, everything's owned by AIPAC. AIPAC sent a powerful message this last congressional election cycle. $100 million spent. Every single person they supported in the primary won, including one that they spent $24 million on. $24 million. We know this because they brag about it. They brag openly about it. Here I am being prosecuted as a foreign agent of Russia for nothing. And Israel is buying American politicians and they just get away with it. I mean, the hypocrisy is just stunning. But, no one's going to do anything because how do you prosecute yourself? Well, first of all, we need to understand that Benjamin Netanyahu only cares about Benjamin Netanyahu. He cares about his political survival. And in that context, we also have to point out that many people, including myself, have written him off before. I thought it was the end of Benjamin Netanyahu when he lost the last election. I thought for certain he'd be arrested, charged, put on trial, spend the rest of his life in jail. But he's a political survivor, and he knows Israel better than just about anybody. And he was able to orchestrate successive collapses of opposition government until he was able to assemble a coalition and win election. And then he did an attack on the courts and ended the ability for him to be prosecuted, at least while he's in office. Let's see what happens when he leaves. But he knows that once he leaves office, there will be an accounting. He will be held accountable not only for his past crimes, but for the perception that he was criminally negligent based upon what happened on October 7th. And now Israel is being held criminally negligent by the world for the actions ordered by Netanyahu, the empowerment of the far right, which brings in, Talmudic thinking when it comes to Israel's relationship with the Palestinians. These are human animals. Rape is permitted, encouraged, on and on and on. So Netanyahu knows that he can't fail. So if you know you can't fail, and you know what the consequences of failure are, that means that you've just expanded the options available to you, because some options, which a rational thinker, a rational player would say, the consequences of failure on that are too grave. We're going to ratchet it down a little bit and take the middle ground. For him, he has no choice. He can't play safe. He has to go hard the whole time. And that's what he's doing right now in provoking these crises. That's what his motivation is, to stay in power. The Israeli Defense Force, I used to work very closely with them back in the 1990s, and I respect their professionalism. This is before I understood about, and before they had been perverted by the far right, which insinuated itself everywhere in Israel, including the military, so that people who once may have had a capacity for human compassion no longer do. Religious fanatics have taken over so that Dahiwa principles, mowing the grass, become the norm. That wasn't the IDF that I dealt with. But the IDF, is professional. They take the job of defending Israel very seriously, regardless of how it's defined, whether it's a Yitzhak Rabin definition of Israel or a Benjamin Netanyahu definition of Israel. The IDF's job is to defend it. The IDF understands that the situation they confront today was never planned for, and there's no contingency for it. They've never planned for a war lasting this long that depletes human and material resources at this rate. They're exhausted, both physically, morally, and materially. They've run out of spare parts for their tanks, so every tank that's damaged is equivalent of a destroyed tank. They're running out of ammunition, aircraft. I'd love to see the Israeli figures on aircraft maintenance. You know, these planes don't fly themselves. And for every hour you're in the air, there's a X number of hours on the ground. These planes have to be shooting through, you know, maintenance windows that can't be maintained because of operational tempo. So there's just a whole bunch of things happening that have the Israeli military saying, we can't continue to do this. Not only can't we continue to do this, but we can't expand this operation into both a full-scale reinvasion of Gaza or a full-scale war with Hezbollah. So there's a disconnect. The Israeli Defense Force leadership is not supportive of the forever war that Benjamin Netanyahu needs to continue to stay in power. They recognize an absolute necessity to bring this war to an end. And so you have a difference of opinions there. And this gets interesting. I just, again, want to remind your listeners that before the October 7th attack took place, Israel was in a state of crisis with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets protesting against Benjamin Netanyahu. And the president of Israel at that time said that Israel was on the cusp of real civil war, not civil conflict, not civil disobedience, civil war between two armed elements who were vociferously opposed to one another, who would fight it out as a war. That situation hasn't gone away. There's still deep divisions within Israel. October 7th, they tried to paper over those divisions, but they're being exposed. And many of those divisions relate to Benjamin Netanyahu as a human being, as a failed political leader. And the Israeli army knows this. They understand how sensitive. Heck, we saw it play out when those nine Israeli soldiers who raped Palestinian prisoners were in prison. And we saw a near civil war break out as elements of the Israeli society and elements within the Israeli military demanded, not only demanded their release, but in one ridiculous moment, were pounding on the doors demanding to be allowed in so they could rape Palestinian prisoners, because apparently rabbis say that that's okay under Talmudic law. So, it's a very, very dangerous situation. The Israeli military is aware of that, and I think that's why you're seeing a split between the Israeli military and Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think the assassinations that took place, again, those assassinations would have been carried out by the Mossad, represent some sort of compromise solution within the war cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu. Both Turkey and Pakistan, but especially Turkey, are prisoners to a domestic political reality that ends up impacting foreign policy decisions more than we in the collective West truly understand. Erdogan is a political survivor. He's been in power a long time, and he does it by playing political games, building, rebuilding coalitions. And he just survived, his party survived a local election where he lost a lot of support because of the Israeli problem. And so he is embracing policy directions, articulating policy, saying things that seeks to repair the damage that was made between himself and his party and the Islamist element of Turkey. I think people should remember that even though the history of modern Turkey, Turkish Republic, is one of a secular republic, that it's always been a deeply Islamist state, and the Turkish people are deeply religious. When I was in Turkey in the 1970s, my father was stationed there. I think there was a guy named Erbakan, or I could be getting that name wrong, but he was an Islamist leader, and there was just problems. He and Ecevit were, and Demirel were wrestling, but the Islamists, the military had to move in, remove them from power, and then they came back. Erdogan is actually part of the Erbakan Islamist movement, but Erbakan step aside, but Erdogan is the, you know, the successor. He's an Islamist. And now he's in power. Turkey is an Islamist state. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a Muslim dominated country. Of course it is. But that's a reality that you can't, you know, engage in secular policies that are seen as being harmful to fellow practitioners of the Islamic faith and not pay a political price. So, you know, I don't, but Turkey's also realistic. It, again, it has goals. Erdogan wants to attend BRICS. He's elected the big pivot away from the EU. You know, he requires stability in the region. Invading Israel is the least destabilizing thing one can possibly imagine. So I think there's a lot of politicized rhetoric. I don't see it, Turkey doing anything precipitous. The same thing with Pakistan. The one thing that I'm, where I would put a lot of focus on, though, is Pakistan has the Muslim bomb. And Israel needs just to keep that in mind. I don't know what deals have been cut between Pakistan and Iran. I do know that any use of nuclear weapons by Israel against Iran will probably not see the consequences finished until nuclear weapons, a Muslim bomb, have been used against Israel. Now, who fires that Muslim bomb? Iran, Pakistan? It doesn't really matter, because Israel is such a small state, the use of nuclear weapons on Israeli soil will terminate the Israeli state. And that's the consequences that Israel needs to understand. That's what bothers me about Pakistan, is it's the fact that it has a Muslim bomb, and they understand the dire consequences of allowing Israel to strike a Muslim state with nuclear weapons without response. Israel has to be put on notice. You can't do it. You can't use nuclear weapons against a, against an Islamic state. So I think that's the role that Pakistan plays. And, you know, there's whispers about this. These are conversations that simply cannot be had in public, you know, by Pakistani government officials. But you also, it doesn't do anybody good to have a theory buried in your head that you don't articulate, so therefore nobody knows about it, especially if the theory buried in your head is supposed to deter people from certain actions. So I'm confident that Pakistan's using whatever mechanisms are available to it to make sure that the potential of extraordinarily dire consequences accrued to Israel if they use nuclear weapons against Iran exists.